Representations and Warranties. This is Brock.
And this is John.
Often referred to as reps and warranties. So what are...
Well, yes, almost exclusively. All the cool kids call them reps and warranties.
All the cool kids. And everybody's cool, so everyone gets a trophy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when we're done with this, it'll be fruit roll-ups and juice boxes for everybody.
What are these?
Reps and warranties are in every acquisition agreement. From both sides, their primary function in public deals is to allocate the risks of the transaction between signing and closing, because they go bye-bye typically when you close the deal. Now, in private company deals, they're going to survive closing for a period of time that's negotiated, and the breaches of them can serve as the basis for post-closing indemnity claims if they don't give you a right to terminate before the deal closes, or if you don't discover them until after the deal closes.
And why aren't they standardized?
To a certain extent, they are, at least to the topics regarding a certain type of business. And there's some boilerplate that everybody's going to have due authorization and compliance with laws, reps, and that type of thing that are going to be covered. But they differ because every business is different, and each deal has different leverage points. Reps and warranties typically cover the waterfront of potential areas of legal and business concern, or at least they're designed to. They cover the general things that are typical in most deals. You'll see reps and warranties as to due incorporation or due organization, capitalization of the company, compliance with laws, authorization of the agreement, absence of any conflicts with other material agreements. Also, will address specific areas like environmental compliance, and that rep can be a little rep. If you're in a service business, nobody's not going to be too concerned about that. But if you are a steel company, it may go on for pages and pages. Taxes, insurance, employee benefits, financial statements. Absence of undisclosed liability, labor matters, absence of defaults, identification of any change in control agreements. And then there may be some more detailed statements about compliance with specific laws that affect the business of the particular parties involved in the transaction and other matters as well. The buyer's reps, and this is generally, because it's not always the case, sometimes they're coextensive, particularly if you have something that's pitched as a merger of equals. But buyer's reps tend to be less extensive than seller's representations. If buyer's a cash buyer and there's no financing issues, they may be quite bare bones because, as long as I know I'm getting good cash at the end of the day, there's not much more that I care about the buyer other than that it's, legitimate business, and et cetera. But reps and warranties from the seller can be very, very extensive indeed, and make sense if you're from the buyer's perspective for that to be the case. If it's a stock deal, the buyer's representations also tend to be more robust, and as I said, in merger of equals, they will look somewhat close to what the seller's reps are. But buyer in a stock deal, you're going to be getting stock, you're getting ownership interest in the buyer. Depending on the size of the transaction, you may not be able to get out quickly. So those reps and warranties will matter more to a seller in a stock deal, perhaps, than they would in a cash deal that isn't subject to financing.
And how does one know which ones are worth negotiating over and which ones are false starts?
It depends, again, on the business, but most people don't spend an awful lot of time on the reps and warranties about due authorization of the agreement and the capital structure, unless there are specific issues that need to be addressed. It's not that those things aren't unimportant, but they're generally not terribly controversial. Okay, I mean, that's stuff you can get cleaned up, et cetera. But anything that goes to value, financial statements, undisclosed liability, compliance with laws, the absence of any defaults under contracts that are important to you, contingent liabilities, ERISA concerns, environmental, intellectual property is particularly in any business with the technology component of significance. It's very important. The absence of change of control provisions are going to make you pay out money at the closing. The kinds of reps that involve complex compliance issues and that involve the potential for a significant impact on valuation, those are usually the ones that people spend the most time on.
And then how can you tell what's market for each one? Is there places you can research?
Yeah, there are lots of ways. You can look at various surveys that are out there, and we've got plenty of those on our deal lawyers and corporatecounsel.net websites. There are databases out there that allow you to search precedent transactions. You can review recent major deals in your industry. You can look at your own firm's inventory of recent deal documents and forms, or your own if you're in-house and your company is an active acquirer, you will probably have an inventory of form documents to look at. But bear in mind that market may have meaning, you know, market in quotes may have meaning only in the abstract. It's a great way to cut through the boilerplate, but all market means is that this is the way it's done in most deals, or you know, at least in most deals that we've been able to find publicly or that there's data on. There may be differences in your situation that require you to depart from customary market practice. So, you know, use market data in drafting and negotiating, but I think the key thing is don't be tyrannized by it. Also, market provisions mean different things in different places. There's often a big difference in the way that lawyers negotiate deal terms in New York versus the way they negotiate them in Silicon Valley, for example. Small deals and private deals are frequently much less driven by concepts of what's market terms than many larger transactions are. These are very frequently kind of one-off, customized deals where those market concepts, if you're tossing companies back and forth between private equity buyers, they may well come into play. But if it's a one-off transaction involving a family business, the market stuff may be of very limited relevance in negotiating a lot of what's important to the parties in that deal.
And what about a junior lawyer? What can their lawyer, doing?
Well, you may be involved in drafting the agreement in some fashion, be involved in drafting the disclosure schedules for sure, that these serve as the qualifications and exceptions to the reps and warranties. And, you know, we talked in another podcast about due diligence, and a big part of due diligence, which the junior lawyers are really take a major, major role in, is identifying potential issues under reps and warranties that need to be addressed. So junior lawyers have a big role in the documentation process and in working around the reps and warranties and making sure that any issue surfacing issues and addressing the ones that are found.
Great stuff. Thank you.
You're welcome.